It's ad break time. I'm pleased to announce that the Beyond Solitaire podcast remains proudly sponsored by Central Michigan University's Center for Learning through Games and Simulations. This week, I have a very special announcement, which is that I will once again be teaching a class for their certificate in applied game design. Come take Using Games to Teach, What You Can Convey Through Play, with yours truly. The class runs from January 22nd to February 29th, and I would love to see you there. A link to the registration page is in the show notes. CLGS's latest game, 500-Year-Old Vampire, just finished a very successful campaign, but if you forgot to back it, you can now pre-order through BackerKit. The link is also in the show notes. I also want to plug my own Patreon. Your support means a lot to me, both emotionally and financially. Patreon money is what makes it possible to keep improving my channel by upgrading the equipment, and I'm also hoping to increase the amount of videos I can publish over the course of the next year. If you want to help out, head over to patreon.com/beyondsolitaire. For now, though, let's get on with the show. Hey, gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and this week on the pod, I have a special guest. This is Roddy Smith, a man who needs no introduction, but if you didn't know who he was, he's from Watch It Played. How you doing, Roddy?
Hey, I'm doing good, Liz. I feel like we've already been chatting so much before we started. It's like we're right in the middle. We're bringing everyone in the middle.
Yes, it's chat. It's appropriate for a classical epic. No, sure. Right. Start in the middle. But first off, thank you so much for coming on the show. I know you're a busy man. I'm very appreciative.
I'm so glad you invited me, Liz. As I was saying to you earlier, I've been enjoying your work from afar, and it's kind of a neat privilege to be able to like join you and get to know you a little better here, and also spend some time with your audience and chat and dive into some hopefully interesting topics for everybody.
Yes. So I invited you on the podcast because I have a feeling that you have a continually growing war game habit. And I think we'll talk about it.
Has it been showing? Has it been noticeable? Yeah, you're right.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. Like, if I recall correctly, you did war game when you were younger.
That's right, Liz. It's something
that's kind of come back into your life. And so how has that, I guess, rekindling of an old romance gone?
Oh, it's been going great. But yeah, you're right. When I was young, my first sort of game outside of the traditional mass market games was Empires in Arms. You familiar with that older title? Okay. I had an Avalon Hill catalog, and it was listing all these games. I picked it up at like I remember the shop sold pool tables. I don't think it was a game store, but it had this Avalon Hill catalog. And I was fascinated because the description for this Empires in Arms game was that it had an 80-page rule book and took 12,000 hours to play, up to 12,000 hours, you know. And it just sort of, no, 12,000 minutes. Well, it doesn't matter. A long time. It just sort of like blew the top off my brain as a young person. I was like, what could this possibly be? Like what would require 80 pages of rules? What is this simulating? And I suppose it's maybe telling that my reaction to that wasn't to run screaming in the other direction, but to beg my parents, help me pay for this, I'll pay you back, type of thing, right?
It was destiny.
It was destiny, kind of. But the thing is, it was like, you know, a really, really complicated game that shines with seven players, and I wasn't going to be able to find one other person who was going to play that game with me. I then later found Ambush, which was a solo war game from back then, and that was really like an incredible, kind of magical thing for young Rodney. But then I don't think I really pursued much in the way of wargaming after that. And I stayed with gaming. You know, I played Magic the Gathering and a variety of other games. But it was, yeah, in the last, well, I don't know when. I don't know when I circled back around to Cuba Libre. But that was really where the love happened. But it started kind of with Andy and Abyss, because my buddy Joel Eddy from Drive-Thru Games had reviewed Andy and Abyss back when it came out. And I thought it sounded fascinating then, and I bought a copy of the game and I unpacked it, and it was kind of like Empires in Arms all over again, where I'm like, oh, I'm never going to find anyone who's going to play this with me. And I hadn't sort of figured out how to play it, but I was like, if I'm struggling, who am I going to, even if I figure this out, who's going to play it with me? And so I packed it away and I sold it, but it just gnawed at the back of my brain about what was in that box and what could that experience be. So long story longer, I did do a couple of video projects with GMT, and they had sent me Cuba Libre. I think they were interested in me maybe doing something with it, but we hadn't formally discussed anything. So it sat on my shelf there, just taunting me. And Matthew Jude, who's also on the Watch It Played team, had a copy, and we just sort of like should we just try to learn this together? Can we just do that, maybe? Because maybe with somebody else, you know, to kind of like help you, to sort of soften the fall of like, I don't know what's going on here, and you can just sort of commiserate with somebody else. Maybe it just was sort of like the a bit of encouragement I needed. And we live streamed reading the rules out loud to each other. It was a 6-hour art performance piece. It's like survival mode, can we get through this? And we did. And that gave a pretty good baseline of like what the game was. It started to come together. And then I sat down one day. I just had kind of like an open free day. And I said, I'm going to sit with this game. I'm going to play every faction myself. And I'm going to figure this out. And Liz, it was love at 12th sight, or whatever we'd call it at that point, because, like, you know, I've been circling these games for a while. But that experience was, I mean, I was just floored. As I took turns, I was like, oh my goodness, and now this faction's going to do this, which is going to pull this lever and cause this effect. And then this faction, what are they going to do? They're jammed in the corner. Oh, they can do this unique thing because all the factions are unique. And so it really, it was like, oh, this is what war games are doing nowadays. Interesting. And it made me want to know more.
I do feel like we have to hit on something important before we get back to actual serious things, which is, it sounds to me like you need to unpack some solo gaming related trauma, Rodney. think about all the people you've left to discover that for themselves.
When you're not wrong.
You cut your teeth on Ambush.
Yeah,
you
I know.
Chickened out of Cuba Libre Solo the first time, and you helped no one. And you needed that.
You're not wrong. It's,
you played all the factions by yourself.
Yeah. If for anyone's not familiar, when I do tutorial videos on my channel, if there's solo rules, I will often leave those for the viewer to discover on their own. And I have certainly found lots of enjoyment in solo play, all the more so since really kind of diving into the war game world a little bit, you know? And it was from, like, learning the mechanisms of the game that got me intrigued about the historical backdrop of Cuba Libre. And that led me down a few rabbit trails of documentaries and books. And then that sort of made me realize the richness that comes from pairing the historical reality. You know, there's a historical reality that's not going to be able to be reflected in cardboard and plastic and whatever. Like, not truly. But it gives you a perspective that I don't think I would not have otherwise had if I hadn't had the experience with the game. And I don't think I would have independently pursued the historical knowledge without the game, frankly. So they were kind of like a married thing in a way.
Yeah, I actually have that same experience of my games and my historical interests reinforcing each other. I think that...
Did you start, though, Liz, with a historical interest? Did you have that before you found games?
So it's kind of a mixed bag. If you look all the way back, you know, my family is always like games, you know, playing card games and stuff like that. But my first interest in games that was like, wow, this is something really special, was actually in a high school history class. I actually interviewed my former teacher, Kirby Whitehead, on this podcast because he had Axis and Allies. And I learned he had some GMT games in his room. And he's become much more advanced. Like, he's actually got his Model UN kids using things like Cuba Libre as like part of a Model UN tournament, where like some of the things in the game come out into the world of Model UN and like into their role playing aspect.
Right.
And, you know, he teaches Here I Stand to European history kids.
So that's pretty intense.
I didn't get that, but I wonder if a seed was planted, right? Because I always thought of myself as kind of a video game person mostly.
Right.
Until I got to graduate school, and it was my way of blowing off steam with my friends. So I had a historical interest because I was pursuing a degree in ancient Christianity. But you have to do something else. And so, you know, I was playing Magic the Gathering, and then, you know, I needed to do something cheaper. So, of course, I got Lord of the Rings Living Card Game, which wasn't really cheaper because now I'm this. But actually, when I quit my academic path, like, I finished my PhD, I became a high school teacher. Leaving academia is like a traumatic experience. It's like getting a divorce. You know,
you said
like
you
a lot
quit
of...
the academic path. Now, I'm sorry, some of your viewers may already be familiar with this, but what do you mean by that?
So basically, when you go to graduate school and you get a PhD, the expectation is that you want to be a professor. And that's really what I thought I was going to be. And, you know, it's more and more common to leave academia in that pathway now because the job market is so terrible.
Okay. But back then.
I had to make it was not cool to do it at the time. But I made a decision to not put myself through that and to instead have more control over where I lived and, you know, be a high school teacher. And so I was... You know, it makes you question who you are. Like, so much of your identity gets wrapped up in academia. And so I kind of saw gaming as separate for a long time.
Right.
But it turns out that you can't take the ivory tower out of a person because I started to develop an interest in historical games later. Yeah. And then I saw somebody at like a Latin convention with the kids that I took my students to who talked about ancient games. They brought him like he was like a local person who gave a lecture. And it was the first episode of my podcast. I kept this guy in my back pocket for like a couple years. And I asked somebody else, if, hey, let's interview him on this podcast. Like, let's just have him on as a guest. No, no, no. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to start my own podcast. And once I started podcasting, it just blew everything up.
So what compelled you to, sorry, I'm making this about you now. what compelled you to say, I'm going to podcast about this?
I think that it kind of ties back to what interests you about war games, right? It's like, a game can be something more than just a game. This can be an entire experience, and I can share that experience with other people. Solo gamers are probably the chattiest gamers too. Like, you wouldn't think so because we play by ourselves, but then we go online and we talk about it. And so,
Well, there's also, let's not forget, when you're playing solo, there's still very much a dialogue happening.
Oh, yeah.
Even when you're alone at that table. Like, I'm having a lot of conversations with myself solo. Yeah.
And with a designer in a really abstract way. This actually leads to, you know, it sounds like I sort of made my internal life into my content. I hate the word content, my media, let's go with that.
Sure.
But you, on the other hand, I sort of feel like there's the Rodney who makes these like really nice slick videos that, you know, maybe I don't know how much control you actually have over like what your schedule looks like. I actually would be really curious to know, like,
I'd be happy to tell you
the orders that come in, right? Versus what you seem to be playing when you have your own time.
Right. Okay. Well,
and so,
In terms of like my schedule for Watch It Played, so I do mostly now almost exclusively tutorials. When the channel first started, it was just me. I did tutorials and gameplays, and it was never just me. I did it with kids or I had other people, but I did a variety of things. I also did a series called Table Talk that was very conversational with different topics of discussion in the hobby. But the reality is I really have a strong passion for making tutorials for board games. I just love doing it, and that's where I threw myself fully in. So I set a goal at the very beginning of the channel 12 years ago that I will never cover a game I don't want to cover. Tutorial videos are just a very, it's a very involved process. And then I also make a commitment to answer every comment on every video that I've ever done. So if I was doing that for games, if I was doing that for games I did not like on some level, I don't think I'd be here talking to you right now. I would have like thrown myself out a window a while ago. So I don't have to love every game I feature, but I have to like something about it, you know? Now, when it comes to what I've been playing off channel, it's been a lot of war games of late, but it's not exclusively war games. I think it's discovering for myself. It's not like I discovered Cuba Libre. Lots of people were enjoying this before, but discovering it for myself and falling down that rabbit hole, I've been excited to talk about it more publicly and share that because I feel like there's a lot of people who maybe see wargaming as something that's maybe not for them, or it's an oddity, or there's too high of a barrier to entry, which I think sometimes there is more so than there needs to be. That's maybe a separate thing to talk about. It's maybe somebody that people might think, well, I've seen Rodney play just one and any other number of games. If he's into wargames, maybe I can too, kind of. Like, that's maybe my hope a little bit. I don't really need anyone playing a game they don't want to be playing. But if I might inspire some curiosity in someone who could enjoy war games, I'm kind of excited to be able to do it because I've gotten so much enjoyment and so much fulfillment out of it. I've always enjoyed the hobby. I've never, in the course of doing this, burnt out on games. That's what I want to do. When I'm not working, I think, I wonder what game I can pull off the shelf. But discovering war games has been like discovering this whole new thing, and that's been really exciting and fun. So I don't know if I answered the question. I'm playing a lot of war games, but I'm also playing a lot of not war games still, too. But
yeah, I mean, I also have a mixed diet, so.
A lot of my gaming right now is remote. And war games work really well for remote gaming. By remote, I should clarify, I don't mean through BGA or Tabletop Simulator or those things, which are also great. But I set the game physically up in my basement, and then I take turns using my phone and, like,
recording what I'm doing, sending that to a friend who also has their copy set up, and then they update their board, then they send me a turn back, and WarGames just work quite nicely for that, because especially with like Koopa Libre, and that's a shared deck, there's no hidden information, so it just works really cleanly. And these are games that you could spend a little bit of time thinking about your turn. Well, now you can spend as long as you want, because no one's sitting around waiting for you to take your turn. Your turn comes in, when I get an update, ping on my phone, I come back to the table and I'll take my turn when I get a chance, kind of thing, right? So it's been a really kind of relaxed, cool way to experience those games.
That's so funny. That's it's like an update on the traditional play-by-mail of Absolutely. Like the very earliest Avalon Hill General like yeah. personal ads.
No, I really think it is. It is just an evolution of that, which kind of charms me a little bit because my brother used to play by mail war games, right? So I'm doing, my brother was 16 years older than I am, but I'm now doing effectively an evolved version of that. But the kind of the nice thing is it's still very, it allows for that kind of conversational at the table experience, even though I'm not at the table with my with the other players, we're talking. They can see me. We're having expressions. We're reacting to things, you know, and it still gives you that kind of at-the-table feel. And I'm still interacting with the game, which I love. Board games, is for me, is such a tactile experience that I like that I can still do that, even in that format.
Do you feel like you have a different relationship with the games that you, I guess, engage with for business versus the games that you play purely for pleasure?
No, but that kind of maybe goes back a little bit to what I said earlier about how, like, I just don't do games I don't want to do. So in that sense, I'm not like, oh, I've got to do this game this week. I got to work on this game. Ugh, you know, I don't have to think that way, because if I pick the game to feature, it's because I wanted to do it. I'm in a fortunate position that way, right? Because I've been doing this for a long enough time that now, because it wasn't always this way, obviously, right? But I've carved out enough of a little space for myself that I have options. Like, publishers want games covered, and what, 1,000 games come out in a year now, over 1,000. I can cover if I go flat out 55. So I'm able to be a little bit choosy in that way. And yeah, I have broad tastes, which is kind of nice too, I think. Like, I really like everything from your Just One to your, you know, thinkiest Euro or whatever.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I just, this is a personal thing for me probably then. I am a crank where if I have to do something, I immediately don't want to do it as much.
Okay. I don't think I suffer from that when I want to do it.
Yeah.
I understand that. You're a little more of a, is that, I don't know what I would call that. Is that being a contrarian a little bit? Like, oh, you want me to do that? Now I don't want to do it anymore.
it's on a deadline. I have to play it now. Oh, no. And like, that doesn't actually change whether I really love a game. So, like, for example, you know, I did all those Gearlock guides for Chip Theory this past year. Mm-hmm. I loved it as a process. I actually still really love Too Many Bones, which I think is saying something after all the time I spent with that game.
That does. Yeah.
But also, there were times when I was like, but it's purely just like a contrarian thing. Like, it'd be like, but look at this thing that I'm not under contract to do it, but
right.
it's over there. Yeah.
Well, listen, I can certainly share that feeling of the work obligation is keeping me from something I'd like to be doing, for sure, because the work obligation has to take a priority. So I definitely encounter that. Like, I've had sitting over in the other room where I have all my remote games, I've had The British Way set up for 4 months now, and I'm 3 pages into the rules, and that's where I stalled out, just because the video production schedule has just gotten a little too busy for me to be, like, partitioning out time to do that. So, yeah, I mean, I want to be playing that, but the thing is, again, I guess I really feel fortunate. I love what I do, so it helps in that regard. Doesn't mean it's not work, though. Like, when I'm staring down the barrel of, you know, 13 hours of shooting a video, I'm not like, wee, yay. But I certainly, at the end of it, you know, I feel a certain level of fulfillment and satisfaction that I get out of that. I'm sure you've experienced the same thing, right? It's like recording this podcast with me is a complete chore, but when you're done, you'll feel fulfilled, hopefully. Sure.
No, actually, I really strictly limit the way I do my podcast specifically to keep myself happy. So I limit myself to a 20-episode season, and then I force a break, even if I'm still feeling it. I make myself take a break. It's actually how I made myself write my dissertation as well. I wrote 2 pages a day, flat, no more than 2 pages. I woke up in the morning, the first thing I did was write 2 pages, and I stopped. No matter how on fire I felt, I would just stop. And I would do some research and, like, outlining for the next day. And then I'd get up the next day and write 2 pages. But I always had 2 pages in the chamber, so I never went for a long time without having anything to say.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I felt like I instead of just letting myself go where the spirit took me, right? It was like, okay, I'm going to regiment this in a way that keeps me hungry.
That's interesting too, because I would imagine, Liz, like if you, let's say you finish your two pages and you're like, I know I have more in me. The upside of pausing is that when you sit down the next time, you've, yep, like you said, you've got something to work with, as opposed to, well, I went for that, did six pages, and now I'm showing up the next day and I have no idea what to say next.
Exactly.
Like I've yes, emptied the tank type of thing. Yes. And that can be demoralizing and almost maybe make a bigger speed bump than if you had like kind of paced yourself. That's interesting, Liz. That's,
Yeah. And that's also true. I never want my podcast to be a chore for me ever.
Right.
Ever. It's my favorite thing that I do. Except for maybe game design, which I've started to do, which I really, really enjoy.
Right.
It's almost like I, the other thing is I'm very picky, congratulations, about who gets to come on the podcast. So I don't record episodes with people I don't want to talk to for an hour. Sort of like you would never cover a game that you don't want to cover.
There you
like,
go. Right.
I'm not
right.
going to have a conversation that I think is a drudge.
Right.
Because there's only 20 episodes per season. That's like precious, right? So you have, you know what I mean? It just kind of builds.
And I could see somebody listening to this and going, like, oh, how nice for you. You only do what you want to do kind of thing, right? But the reason for that, and maybe this is similar for you, is if I can't do it the way I want to do it, I'll just do something else. Like this thing when I started was, yes, I had a real interest in seeing if I could do this full time. I knew that I felt making tutorial videos for board games was something that maybe I had an aptitude for, and there was maybe a need for it.
Yeah.
And so I decided, if I'm going to do this, I want to do this a way that I can do in the long run, like that I'll be able to do it in a sustained way. So if I make a bunch of compromises, I won't, you know, I'll burn out. I won't be able to keep doing this forever. But if it doesn't work the way I want it to work, then I tried. Let's fail fast and then go get a job where, you know, I have to do what the boss wants me to do or whatever, right? Like it was, you know, the only reason I'm able to sort of stick to that is because it worked. If it hadn't worked, I would have bailed and done something different, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that doing what works for you, there is something to that if you have to be your own boss in any regard, if it's your project.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to something that you said earlier, which is that, first of all, you admitted you, a rules lord, to being confused by Koopaly right now. But no, actually, I wanted to tie that back in. So you mentioned that there's some accessibility concerns for war games. And I guess I wanted to talk about that a bit because who would be better able to discuss that than like Rules Master? So...
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, I'll tell you something. War games sometimes make me wonder how much of a rules master I am, because I look at the war game side of the hobby and I see a lot of barriers in the way the rule books are presented. And yet, I cannot deny there are lots of war gamers. So somehow you're all figuring this stuff out. But I look at it sometimes and I think you're figuring it out in spite of, not because war game rule books are actually presented well. Now, this is broad strokes. For all of you major war game fans, I apologize if you're sitting there going like, these war game rule books are great for me. Wonderful. I have found there to be some distinct differences in the way war game rule books present themselves compared to other rule books that I've spent a lot of time, you know, reading and learning from. And this isn't always true, but I find, here's how I would summarize it. I find that war game rule books often tell you the rules, but they do not teach you the rules. And I think there's a weird, subtle difference there that's very difficult to define, but it's a lot of listing information as opposed to explaining that information that's being listed. Now, it's technically maybe all there, but the rule book is not doing a lot of the heavy lifting of the teaching part for you. Now, I think war games have tried to complement this by having their rule book be very, like, a perfect rules reference, and then they include some other book that's sort of like, here's four people playing the game. Let's watch over their shoulders as they play. And then you'll sort of see it all in action. I'm not convinced that's really like the best way to learn rules personally. Like, for example, when I'm teaching games, I don't say, hey, sit down here, watch me play the game. I actually teach the game. I teach the rules and then say, here, you go off and play it type of thing, right? And I think there's a lot of examples of lots of rule books that teach you the rules as they're explaining the rules. Like, explain the rules as they're teaching them to you, right?
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. Like I've got Star Wars Rebellion here, off screen, and this is like, you know, this is not an insignificant game. I don't know. War gamers might say, okay, there's a game that maybe is in the weight of some of the war games that are out there, right? And when I look at the rules here, what's a good example? Well, here's something. So here's a little paragraph, if you'll indulge me. Assignment phase. During this phase, players assign their leaders to missions. Missions represent pivotal moments from the Star Wars saga, such as stealing the Death Star plans. Each player has a hand of mission cards that represent the different missions his leader can attempt. His, of course. His or her.
Obviously.
There. So the way I think a rulebook would have written that whole paragraph would have been, during this phase, players assign their leaders to missions. Period. Moving on. There wouldn't have been any kind of like, missions come from cards that you're holding in your hand, and you'll be playing these, and they represent X. You know what I mean? Like, there's like the rule book is being a little. This rule book is being a little more narrative. It's giving you some context and giving you a sense of place as it's telling you about the rule. If it had just said during this mission, players assign their leaders to missions, that would have been technically correct. That is technically the rule. That's what happens. You know, but in war game rule books, like Salerno 43, which is just been. I love a GMT, but this is murdering me trying to learn this game. It is just one sentence after the other of contextless sentences. One after the other, after the other, after the other. Now, I am confident that if I could hold all of those contextless ideas in my brain all at once, this would be no problem. And of course, I know people are playing this game, so obviously it can be done. If you'll allow me, just one more thing. I know I've been going. I think another thing that maybe happens in war game rulebooks is there a presumption of knowledge. So there are multiple games in this series. I don't know what the rulebook looks like for the very first one that was released. But when I'm reading this, I feel like there's a lot of presumption of knowledge here. But you've played five of these games already. So we're just going to kind of, you know, bounce you through some of the differences and changes here. You'll figure it out. That's a weird thing. Liz, have you got time for me to rant a little bit longer?
Go for it. Please do.
Okay, one more thing. One more thing.
I love Salerno. Rants.
Salerno 43. And I do. I am really curious about you. I really want to play you someday. I really want to understand you. But, like, when you open up the rule book, it gives you, very nicely at the beginning, very nicely, a sequence of play outline, just to let you know, here's what a round looks like, okay? And it tells you where to find all the rules related to these items. So the very first thing is the roll for weather. This is the very first thing you do. Now, just so you understand, this rule book is, and I know you know this, Liz, but this rule book has all kinds of numbered sections that go from 1 to 25. Okay,
1 to 25.
2.3. Right, exactly. So 25 is at the back of the rule book. 1 is at the beginning. So the very first thing you do in the game, the very first thing is roll for weather. Do you want to guess where that's explained in the rule book? 22.1. So the very first thing you have to know how to do is actually right at the back of the rulebook. Let's listen. Maybe there's something that's just a random thing. Let's go to the next thing. Ready air and naval support markers, 22 as well. Adjust supply points, 22.3. Okay, so maybe there's some weather phase stuff that's for later. Fine. Let's move on to the next thing. The German player turn. Okay, getting into player turns. Cool, great. Use supply points to flip ASUs to the ready side, 17.5. So I got to read all the way to 17.5 before I get to the first thing a player actually does in the game. Well, second or third thing. I find that a little peculiar. Interesting approach. I am absolutely certain this is an amazing rules reference, though. Like, once you know how to play the game, and you're like, I need to know how weather works, I'm going to be able to find that rule in a heartbeat, and it's going to be just nice and precise, and it's going to be awesome. But learning? Liz, it's killing me. It's killing me. So anyway, I think if the average person was to pick up this small little boxed game and go, oh, look, a neat intro level, because it's also kind of like advertises one of the easier ones to get into from the series. I think it would be very much like, oh, none of this is for me. Like, no one's trying to help me get into this system. This is, what is this? I think that's the messaging I would feel, and I do feel.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. So I am a teacher by trade, and I also love to make tutorials. Mine are much chattier because I spend a lot of time giving context for why things are happening, because to me, that's how I learn. And so I wish I had more time to do more of them, because I do love doing them for war games. But the act of learning a war game the first time is horrible unless there's someone else to teach you. It's much easier when it's transmitted person to person.
Yeah, and I think that's something else that maybe war games rely on a lot of. I mean, I think that's a lot of board games rely on that, generally speaking. People like to be taught by somebody else. That's actually part of the reason why I started Watch It Played. Was back in the day, before I started the channel, and I knew I wanted to create some kind of media for board games. I had this, like, I want to share my passion for it, you know? And there was a great thread on BGG where someone just said, like, how do you like to learn war games? And I assumed, because I was on BGG, I knew what the answer was going to be. We all love reading rule books, right? No, it turns out the majority of that thread was people saying, I hate reading rule books. I want someone to teach me. And that's when a little light bulb went on over my head, like, oh, I love teaching board games. So if that's what you, is that what people are looking for? I'll do that. Like, that will be something. I can be the person who you're looking for to maybe be the friend at the table who can help teach, you know? Yeah, like you, I like to teach, I like to help. And I think sometimes maybe war games kind of presume, well, someone's going to teach you, or someone will make a video or whatever. And I like making videos, but I like to think that my video is a compliment to the rule book, you know, well, that you could get by just on the rule book alone. There's not always going to be a video for a game.
Nope, especially not if you're a solo player like me.
Right, so. especially if one of the guys who makes
I had to go find
games.
Out on my own, Rodney.
Yes, I know. I'm sorry.
So this conversation is a delight for me, in part because you went on a rant, because I feel like you present a very smooth persona on your channel. You're very polite. You're very measured. I don't know what you're like when you're angry or if you get angry. I'm assuming you do, but perhaps you go, I'm fine. Yeah.
No, I can get pretty worked up. That was a sense of it.
But it's really nice actually to like get to talk to you about this. And it made me want to lead into another part of the discussion I want to have, which is that I wanted to kind of know when you think it's important to editorialize versus not, because I feel like that's something you steadfastly do not do about games. Like even, you know, I had to probe you to get you to talk about feeling obligated to play a game because you like all the games. You would never play a game you don't like. Because partially I believe that's true. Partially I think that you don't want to say anything bad about anything. But I just got you. But, you know, that makes sense for you in a professional capacity. At the same time, on Twitter, you're a different man, Rodney. But you occasionally
did you not know someone else manages the Twitter account? It's not me.
I saw those. It's the AI videos of Rodney. Everyone giving opinions. It's just the Rodney voice. No, but it's really interesting to see your Twitter persona. Well, I think it's still you. It's just a different facet. But you know, you do like to weigh in on certain issues that are like communal board game issues. So, what is it that makes you feel like it's time to speak up, and how do you make those decisions as a professional and also a person in our hobby?
Okay, I'll answer the easier part first, but don't let me get away with just answering the easy part. The easy part is I don't do that editorializing in the tutorials because I feel this real strong desire to get you in and get you out as quickly as humanly possible. My feeling is you don't really want to hang out with the Canadian guy. You actually want to just go play this game. So how quickly can I teach you this? I want to give you enough context, enough conversation so that it doesn't feel like it's just rapid fire. But I'm trying to get you in and out. And also, I'm not interested in convincing you to like the game or not like the game. So I don't offer my opinions on games. I just feel this real... I think it's very difficult to tell somebody else whether or not they'll have a good experience with the game, no matter what my experience was, because I just find games are such personal experience. Just like music, movies, art, we can both look at the same thing and have a wildly different experience of it. So I'm very, and anytime I say this, I always feel self-conscious because there's lots of people who offer their opinions on games, and I'm so thankful that they do. I'm so thankful that there's people who are confident in that space. I've just never felt confident in that space doing that. So that's why I don't editorialize as much, for example, in a tutorial video. Also, I'm trying to keep it somewhat milk and toast in a way. I want it to feel kind of relaxed. Getting hit with 20 pages of rules, someone talking to you, it's a big info dump, right? So I want it to be kind of just calming and relaxing and let's get through this together, you know, and go have your fun. But, that's maybe the easy answer on that part. For a long time, I don't think I really did editorialize too much on social media either, or outside. Sometimes I would weigh in on a gaming-related topic, even on my own channel, in a separate video, whether that was like, you know, paid reviews or other things like that that struck me, or maybe I felt like I had something to say about, or the effect of hype and things like that. But I don't know. I don't know what I would credit. I would probably have to credit... Gosh, this is, how do I talk about this? I think there were times in the board game media space where people were trying to talk about serious issues that were affecting them that honestly were not affecting me at all in the slightest. Mm-hmm. And as a friend to some of these people, I didn't understand why they were frustrated or bothered by something in the board game hobby, and didn't weigh in, didn't offer support, didn't know how to. And some of that comes from ignorance. And I think, thankfully, through the patience of my friends and listening a little bit to some of the frustrations that have been expressed, it penetrated kind of whatever shell I had to go, oh, right, I'm not experiencing these things that these people are talking about, but this is being experienced en masse. I'm hearing it too many times. This is not a fluke. There's a shared experience of whether it's women in the hobby or marginalized. Well, look, we were just reading earlier out of the Star Wars Rebellion Learn to Play rulebook. I read this rulebook out loud as a joke on my channel, cover to cover. Every second word in here is he. And when I was reading it, I had converted all those in my head to they. And it was really simple. I don't know why the rulebook couldn't do that. Now, people will say, well, who cares? Pronouns, whatever. I think that what helped me start to just understand a little bit is when Plat Hat Games started putting she pronouns in their rulebooks. And when I was reading them, I went, oh, I don't feel like I'm being talked to anymore. And then a little light bulb went on over my head. I was like, oh, this is what someone else could feel like when it's framing it all towards a pronoun that you don't relate to or you don't connect to. And it was just that little chisel that went, oh, how effortless would it be to just make it much more inclusive in the language, right? That's a small little thing, but not a small thing to a lot of people, right? Who have tried to talk about it and express that. And here's the thing, whether you care about these issues or not, historically what I found was when someone did care and would talk about it in a calm and rational, reasoned way, they were often mocked, derided, told to be quiet, it's just about the games, what's your problem, why are you yelling at us? There was a lot of like this very strong dismissive pushback, and yeah, at some point in time I couldn't not see that anymore, I guess, and maybe that's part of the editorializing a bit. Maybe it's trying to make up a little bit for some lost time, and seeing some of my colleagues who dealt with some of that stuff, and realizing if some of us who could have had said some things earlier on, maybe we'd be in a slightly different place now. Maybe. I don't know. The other thing, too, is like it's some of the editorializing. You put yourself in this position where people will, then dismiss you as trying to be a white knight or virtue signaling or whatever. And I think I can't help but see some of that commentary that is just a way of like, so I should shut up then? Like, that doesn't feel right either. Like, oh, I guess I don't want to be accused of that, so therefore I guess I won't say anything. And that feels to me like how one side of the conversation gets to keep having their side of the conversation. So I just have told myself, or I try to think about, what's my motivation for saying this? Do I have something to contribute? Generally speaking, if I do weigh in on something, I try to present it from, well, here's what I've learned. Here's what I think I've been guilty of in the past, and maybe I've seen how this could be different for me, so maybe this is meaningful to you. You know, I try not to make it an accusatory thing as much as maybe sharing some of my own experience. I don't know, Liz, does any of that make sense?
No, it does make sense. And I find it interesting that, you know, you are pretty much a stone cold professional about the games, but I think I'm not saying it's not professional to give an opinion, because I think it is. I think it's important. I mean, do you feel a sense of responsibility from the position that you're in as one of the largest gaming channels to weigh in? Like, do you think you have a responsibility to do it?
And by that, you don't mean on opinions on games as much as...
Yeah, no, social. Like on issues in our community. Yeah.
And I feel a little funny about saying that, because at the end of the day, when I started making videos about board games, I was a guy in my basement talking to a camera, and these 12 years later, I'm a guy in my basement talking to a camera. So something changed, right? Like, but it also didn't, you know what I mean? And, but it's difficult not to see it's hard not to talk. Like the talk about AI and board, AI art and board games, right?
Yeah.
That's a conversation that flared up recently, and I have to admit, like I wrestle with that in my brain. And because I have a slightly larger platform, I'm also like hearing a lot of things, right? Because people are interacting and talking. There's things in the comments. I'm feeling like, oh, there's like a tide going a certain way, and I wonder if that tide's going the right way. And I wonder if we could all just pause and just think about a couple of other things before we all jump on, like the AI art bandwagon. Like,
yeah.
But are my concerns really? Does anyone need to pay attention to me? I don't know.
Like, so I wondered to myself at the start, like as people started to weigh in, I was like, I wonder if Rodney's going to say anything or not. And I'll tell you the reason that I wondered is because you love board games and you teach them because you love them.
Right.
But you also have a business where publishers come to you and commission work from you. And right. So if our industry swings in a direction where AI takeover does happen, and right. there's a limit on the number of games that you can take that don't have that kind of art in them. I mean, I'm a public school teacher. Like, I don't make any money, but I certainly don't make any money off of YouTube.
Right.
So yeah, like, yeah. you know, for yeah. me, I can pretty much say what I want because screw it. Like, what's going to yeah. happen? Right. The same people who weren't hiring me continue to not hire me. Like, oh no. But in your...
No, I see what you're saying. It's not.
But in your case, you have more to lose.
You're saying the stakes might be a little different, potentially,
yeah.
for me.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's a tricky thing, Liz. I don't want to burn bridges for no reason, but I also don't want to keep bridges up for the wrong reasons either. Like, and that's a tricky thing, because at the end of the day, I need to also, like, I would love to be able to keep doing this for the rest of my life. This is what I want to do. And there is a financial reality to that. I can't do it unless I'm getting paid and publishers want to, they see value in what I'm doing to hire me to be able to do tutorial videos and things. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know, Liz. Like, I don't know at what point I will compromise. I'm still human. Well, at some point in time, maybe I'll compromise.
Right?
Maybe once everything becomes AI artwork, I'll be like, well, I've lost this battle, so I'm not going to stop teaching board games, so I guess I got to now teach these goofy-looking AI board games. I got an email today from somebody, and it was like, hey, we have this game. It's going to be awesome. We'd love for you to do a tutorial video for it. Here's a link to our little video. And the whole video was, it was clearly all done in AI voiceover, AI artwork on all the cards, AI... I'm pretty sure the video itself was put together just by AI, you know, animations and AI and everything. And it was like just the you know, the most horrible looking thing, right? Now, AI is the worst it's ever going to be. It's only going to get better from here. And I don't actually have, just for those who are maybe don't know some of the things I've said, I don't have something against necessarily AI art. My main concern is, are we skipping a step? If the AI models are taking copyright materials, things created by other artists, and that's being used to teach or to fuel the database without compensating the artists, that makes me feel uncomfortable. You know, and I feel like that's the part I have an issue with. If the artist had the option to opt in and say, yes, you can use my artwork to teach your model, I'd feel differently. Now, listen, there's going to be counterarguments to that. What's the difference between a computer looking at a piece of artwork and an artist looking at a piece of artwork and copying it? This is probably not the conversation we need to dig in right now, but I think there are distinct differences.
Differences
between what a machine is doing and what a human is doing. And I think sometimes we romanticize a little bit what the machine is doing because we're wowed by it. Because it's kind of impressive, like, that the machine can do that. And so it starts to feel like this almost sentient robot-like thing. And I don't think that's what we have right now. I think we have something closer to a photocopier. More sophisticated photocopier. But if I ran a picture through a photocopier and I got my photocopy, I wouldn't say, look what the machine was inspired to create. Now, again, that's a silly example, and I know AI art is more complicated than that. But I think right now on the spectrum of AI being truly inspired the way humans are and a photocopier, I think we're closer to this right now. Now, we might get somewhere else later, but I think we're more like here. But we're kind of treating it like we're here. And I, anyway, like I said... So sometimes when those things come up, yeah, when these topics come up, it's not that I feel I'm right. I don't know, especially on this topic. I don't know exactly, but I have a leaning. And so I kind of like think, well, maybe I have a way of expressing it that perhaps would make someone think and wonder about those things and then ask themselves those questions and be challenged by it and then pause and think about it before going, hey, cool, look, AI art, let's put it in everything. Yeah, I don't know.
I think also, and I want to poke here just because I like to use, so this is what I always do on my podcast. You know, AI art, I think that part of what you're saying is something we have in common, is that part of what bothers you is missing that human element in a game, that making contact with another person. You know, you like to teach games because you like to game with people. You right. like to respond to every comment. You're really interested in communicating with people. so, you know, I mean, this also actually makes me wonder about, you know, your teaching style too. Like, you talk about kind of getting people in and out because they want to go play their game.
Right.
But how much of a personal touch do you think you need as a teacher to kind of make the teach work? Because my classroom operates solely on my willpower powering that classroom at this point.
Yeah.
How I choose to express it, you know, but that's live with a bunch of teachers who don't necessarily want to be there.
No. That's a very different and challenging environment to be in. I can't see what my quote unquote students, how they're reacting to anything I'm saying. I have a shield that way. You know what I mean? Like when you're teaching to someone live and someone's like snoring or on their phone or whatever, that really can sort of change your whole flow and your own psychological well-being, I'm sure, you know, as a teacher.
Does having that experience? Sorry. Yeah, well, I mean, you've taught live before. Like, how does having that experience impact what you choose to do in your videos?
I try not to bake too much, again, kind of conversational stuff into the tutorial. I mean, I hope it's friendly. I'll get the comment every now and then from somebody who's like, you smile too much in your tutorial videos. You seem too happy. Could you knock it off, kind of thing, right? And I understand. It's especially kind of probably jarring when I'm explaining the theme to a game. And I'm like, in this game, you're going to be playing as aliens ripping the heads off of whatever, and I'm smiling ear to ear. But I think part of the impetus for that for me is, I know that rules are intimidating. And for some people, especially people who are not initiated into the hobby yet, and I always believe whatever video I'm making could be the first encounter somebody is having with, let's say, a modern style board game, right? And I just want them to be met with a cheerful face of somebody who doesn't seem in too much of a rush, but is excited to have them there, and don't worry, we're going to get through this together, and everything's going to be fine. Like, that's kind of the feeling I want everyone to have. And I want that for the person who's a seasoned player, who's just like, I need help with this, or I just want help with this, or whatever the case may be, right? So that's, I guess that's where that piece of it comes from. But if there's anything that maybe I'm half decent at when it comes to the format of how I try to think about approaching a tutorial and watch it played. And I've shared this in other places, so I apologize for anyone who's heard me say this before, but I think there's something really important you have to do if you want to teach a board game well, and that is forget what you know. Which, of course, you can't do because you have to know it to be able to teach it. But you have to remember what it was like before you knew it, so that when you're teaching it, you're remembering what the person you're talking to has in their head, because they don't have in their head all the things you have in your head.
Right.
And the thing I notice all the time is someone's teaching a mechanism or whatever, and they've just rambled off five words in that sentence. And five of those words, they haven't defined any of them anywhere, because in their mind, they're like, I don't know what these words are. So this is not like a weird, confusing thing, but it is to the person who hasn't read the rule book yet. They don't know what those words meant yet. So you got to like remember, oh, this person doesn't know that word, so I got to start there. I got to define these terms. Then we can graduate to putting those terms together to explain, you know, the mechanism or what have you, right? And then there's the order in which you explain the mechanisms. Are you building concepts on top of each other? Or, as in the case of Salerno, are you starting with something that's actually at the back end that you're going to do last in the game, and the thing you're going to do first in the game, we're going to put that at the back of the rule book, so that as you're learning, you don't actually have a growing picture of the game. It's just all these disparate parts, you know?
Yes.
And I have one more little rant. I think that rule book writers sometimes do this little shortcut for themselves, not considering the rule book reader, which is sometimes you'll get a rule book where they'll outline a whole bunch of concepts, disparate concepts, like here's what discarding is. Here's what drawing cards is. Here's what these icons mean. Here's what this type of combat is. Here's what the da-da. And then they get into, and here's how the game goes, right? And then they start teaching the rules. And what they're expecting you to do is take these individual items and then plug them in. Like, read all these disparate things, hold them all in your brain, and then when I use that term later, just insert that here. I think that's like a rules writing shortcut thing, because the rulebook writer doesn't want, they want to just sort of get all the complicated stuff out of the way so they can then just teach you how to play the game over here.
Right.
But when I'm learning, I don't want to have to memorize 15 different abstract concepts that don't plug into anything yet. And then now I'm like 5 pages in reading the next 10 pages. I have to remember those first 5 pages and then plug them in here. I'd rather just start me with how the game starts. And then as those items come up, yeah, tell me it then. And now it's sort of fitting into this sort of story as opposed to just a whole bunch of separate things. So I don't know why I was saying that, but that's another thing I feel about rule books.
But it actually leads me to another question for you. So I think that, I mean, one of the reasons I had you on here is I think that one of the things we do also have in common is that we both are, I guess I'll just use the term evangelist, war game evangelist. Like, we want other people to experience the joys of war and historical gaming because it really is wonderful. But, you know, there's still much that people are left to find out about on their own.
Yes.
And so,
not just the solo rules, all the rules. Good luck.
As somebody who is an expert on rules and who has really thought about how people approach rule books and who remembers what it's like not to know something.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for people who want to explore this but don't know how to get going? Because sometimes they will be on their own.
Define the this. Who want to explore
like,
war games?
You're going to do war games, yeah.
Okay. You know what I would recommend, honestly? Everything I just said in this, how long we've been talking about war games and some of my negative feelings about them, again, I feel like that's a trend, but it's not all of them. And David Thompson, for example, has written the rules in his Postman's in Uniform, and what's that whole series called? Do you remember?
Oh, the Valiant Defense series.
Valiant Defense series.
Yes.
David Thompson doesn't always write the rules to his own rule game, his own war game. Sometimes the publisher does it. Sometimes, you know, there's a variety of different ways it can be done. My understanding is, for that series, he wrote them himself, and I feel like it shows, and he is a master. He will not just tell you the rule, but teach you the rule, but then immediately follow that with 3 examples, with illustrations. And those examples will include those weird edge case situations, so that when you're done, you're like, I have a comprehensive, complete understanding of this one action. I'm now ready to hear about action number 2. And it just keeps building on top of it. It's just some of the best war game rule books I have ever read, just in terms of their comprehensiveness. Now, the downside, and some publishers would see this as a downside, is the rule book is like maybe 20, 30 pages, right? There's a marketing element, which is if my rule book is 5 pages, it looks like an easier game. It looks more approachable. It's less intimidating. I just really don't like that at all because I feel like it's a lie. The reality is, if you want to make a 5-page rulebook for marketing reasons, design a 5-page rulebook game. If you've designed a 30-page rulebook game, then please give me all 30 pages. Don't artificially trim out a bunch of stuff, leave out examples, or make the print really, really tiny. You know,
yeah.
David Thompson maybe goes almost. I don't think you can go too far, honestly. But he goes right on the other extreme. I'd love to see more people aiming for that, honestly. So there are war games I think that are approachable that way, and he's made a series of them, and those are solo ones you can just jump into on your own.
Yes. Well, I mean, we all know I'm biased towards David Thompson because he and I are doing Night Witches. But I have bad news for everybody, which is that I'm the primary writer on the rulebook for that. So if anything's wrong with it in the future, it's my fault.
Well, have you written rulebooks before?
No, it's my first one.
Okay, well, then we will be judging. Harshly
judging. Go for it.
Well, listen. You certainly got a partner there who can maybe help offer some advice as you figure it out.
Oh, yeah.
I also think, Liz, for all my criticism here, I hope people will take it in stride. Because the reality is, it's much easier to criticize something than to start from a blank page and create something. Okay? It's much easier for me to come in here and go, here's what's wrong with this rule book. But if you'd given me the blank pages and told me all the rules of Salerno 43 and now I had to write the rule book, I can assure you I'd do it differently, But it doesn't mean that I wouldn't have had some made some errors too, and had people scratching their head, etc. Right?
Absolutely. And then I guess, you know, we've touched on it a bit, like talking about history and historical influence, but and interest. But what is it about war games that makes them worth the trouble?
Huh. Hmm. Well, this is very subjective. But I have found, like, for example, when I learned Cuba Libre and played it, I found the experience and the way it made my brain sweat and the mechanisms and all of that really fascinating. To me, I was just wildly fascinated by it and have played the game, I don't know, like 20 times now. And I'm still loving playing it. All the different coin games, they all sort of like pull me in. So there's definitely like that part of it, which is, I don't know how you sort of pin that down, because someone else could play that game and mechanically not enjoy it at all. Like, someone else might not have that fun moving those pieces around and having that experience. There's that. I think there is something about it being grounded in a historical setting that I think adds layers to it. You know, I found after playing Cuba Libre, you know, being curious about what was going on here. Because a lot of the cards, in the deck, they show illustrations, they talk about historical events. The rulebook itself and the playbook provide additional details about the history. So I read through all that, then I watched some documentaries, started reading books. And it gives you a level of appreciation, I suppose, about not just the game, but what it's modeling and what it represents, and maybe kind of expands your mind even a little bit as a human on the planet. You know, I feel like there's things I've learned about war and conflict that are not necessarily great, but they're true, you know, just in terms of like tensions between different factions and human casualty and terror and its place in conflict and all the rest of it. And you, I don't know, there's something in that makes the game more than just a game anymore. Because like when I'm playing a trick-taking game, I'm not having a bigger experience. Like the experience is the trick-taking game, and that's fun and that's great. And games don't have to be more than that if you don't want it to be, right? But I think historical war games do invite you to consider something beyond just the game itself.
And I think that is a perfect spot to ask you, other than Cuba Libre, what have you been playing recently that brings you some joy?
Well, it's another coin game. I'll give you two answers. I'll give you two answers. One that's bringing me joy, and one that's not bringing me joy. And I will stop picking on Salerno 43, so it's not going to be that. Which Salerno 43, I will eventually master. Have me back on sometime in the future. We'll talk about how I did with it. People Power. Have you played People Power?
You know, it's on my to-do list, and I'm very excited about it.
This is a three-player coin game. And for the longest time, I would have said Cuba Libre was like the ideal starting coin game. It might still be. For a little while there, I was like, oh, I think it might be People Power. There are certain things about People Power that are a little, I think, a little easier. But there's a fragility to the balance in that game. And I could see first-timers feeling like one faction's way more power than the other. And I don't think that's what's going on. It just takes a while to understand what you have to do to kind of like counteract what they can do. I think it's one of those situations where there's a faction that might be quote unquote a little easier to play. And so it might take a little while for the other players to kind of catch on to what they have to be doing.
Right.
But I have found that one just really, really interesting, really tickles my brain. I'm mystified still by like, you know, what the right thing is to do in any given situation, but I'm really enjoying it. The one that's causing me a little more like gritting my teeth kind of feeling is Inferno, my first Levian campaign attempt.
Ooh.
That's not me disparaging the game. It's just, this is another one of those situations where the rulebook is very dense. It's a lot of telling you, not necessarily teaching you, and there's a lot of moving parts. And I feel like It's a slightly higher hill to climb than People Power was. So I'm in that more like sweaty part of trying to just figure out what the heck's going on in it stage. So I'm not having fun yet, exactly. But there might be fun on the other side of that effort. We'll see.
I believe. What I always ask people, not that anybody actually needs to ask this about you, but where can you be found online?
Sure. No. So if you're interested in watching any of our videos, we have tutorial videos, gameplay videos, and a variety of other types of content on the channel, including news and everything else, and some solo. We have a solo series called Table for One, where we teach and play the solo rules for some of the games too. That you can find us over at youtube.com/watchitplayed. And then like on social media, if you just look up Watch It Played, that's probably us on there under that, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or any of the other number of social media places that are popping up these days.
Fantastic. And I, of course, am Beyond Solitaire everywhere online. And every time Rodney tells you to go discover that on your own, just come to me. I got you.
That's right. Come see Liz. It's a partnership, Liz. We're working together. Liz, thank you so much for having me on. This was such a delight. I hope people enjoyed some parts of this conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you and talking about these subjects that are not something that I because you're right, on the channel, I don't really have an avenue where I would talk about this way. So it's nice to be able to do it. Thank you.
Yeah, it's so nice to get to know you better. Like, you know, it's now I can be like, oh, hey, it's Rodney. We're
hey, we're buds.
You know, I've been watching your stuff for years, but you know, it's fun to actually make contact. We've like exchanged a couple of Twitter messages and like that's it. So this is really cool for me too. I really appreciate your time.
A pleasure.
So everybody out there, please like, subscribe, comment, ask questions, and most of all, happy gaming.
Bye, everybody.